Have you ever heard of a poet who went viral? And if you have, then ask yourself this. Have you ever heard of a poet who went viral and was a farmer from the countryside? Although, where else would a farmer be from? If you've heard of both of those things, then how about this? Have you ever heard of a poet who went viral, is a farmer from, you know, the bottom of society, and is also disabled, in this case has cerebral palsy? Well, the poet whose work we're looking at in this episode is all of those things. It's Yu Xiuhua, and the book is Moonlight Rests on My Left Palm. Our guest for the episode is the translator of that book. So you can look forward to my interview with her. You'll find out who she is soon, if you don't already know. But before we get to that, we're going to cover the news, the translated Chinese fiction news. Now, the first item I'm going to cover here, it's fairly hardcore. It's real news, I would say. Essentially, there has been a dispute, for lack of a better word, perhaps there is a better word, between the British Museum and translator Yilin Wang, who you may remember was on the show way back when I did the Wuxia season. So long story short, and you can get the long story on Twitter, Yilin has laid out her account in many, many tweets. And there's a whole, you know, lots of conversations you can get. You can get a sense of what's going on. But essentially, Yilin has been translating this poet from 100 or so years ago called Zhou Jian for quite a long time now. I guess it's been an extended artistic or translator's project. And the British Museum used some of her translations in an exhibit about, I think, what is it? It's called Unseen China or something. It's about something from the Qing Dynasty, which is when I believe Zhou Jian was writing. But yeah, the point is the British Museum used some of Yilin's translations without reaching out, without getting permission, without naming her, anything like that, and essentially got caught. And that is where the story has unfolded from. So rather than me laying it all out in exhaustive detail, if this interests you, if the name the translator sort of movement is something you're interested in, then there are articles about this online, and of course there's all the tweets. So go check that out. Okay, next news item. This one is pretty mental as well, I suppose. This is a new book coming out that is a real, I would say, all-star lineup. It's published by Urbanomic, but I think possibly published in the US or some way linked with the MIT Press. I don't quite get the relation. But in any case, this book is called, and it's nonfiction, Machine Decision is Not Final, China and the History and Future of Artificial Intelligence, edited by Benjamin H. Bratton, Anna Greenspan, and Bognokon Noir. Or I realize now it's not Noir, it's K-O-N-I-O-R. She's Polish, I'm afraid. I'm not up on my all Polish pronunciations. But yeah, so aside from these editors, we really have a pretty mental lineup. I'll just read all the authors' names first. Okay, here we go. I believe we have two former show guests in here, but I'll just rocket through them. Blaise Aguera, I'm realizing there's going to be some names I can't pronounce properly, so bear with me. Blaise Aguera y Arcas, An Bo, Benjamin Bratton, Chen Qiufan, Gabriela Di Seta, Shuang Frost, Vincent Garten, Steve Goodman, Yvette Granata, Anna Greenspan, Amy Ireland, Bognokon. This is the one I should know because I've talked about Bogna in other Church of Fake Newses, but Bognokon Noir, Vincent Le, Lawrence Leck, Lucas, oh dear, Likavsan, probably got that wrong, Suzanne Livingston, Iris Long, Meng Bingchun, Reza Negrestani, Wang Hongzhi, Regina Kanyu Wang, Wang Xin, Xiajia Yomi. I guess I'll read the blurb next, rather than telling you why I'm excited about this. An interdisciplinary, cross-cultural collection that decenters familiar narratives to provide a fresh perspective on what artificial intelligence is today and what it might become. Historians, media theorists, science fiction writers, philosophers, and artists from China and elsewhere re-examine the nation's intense engagement with AI, moving beyond the cliches that still dominate the contemporary debate. Visions of the contested future of AI veer between common planetary goals, and a new Cold War as culturally specific models of intelligence, speculative traditions, and thought experiments come up against the emergence of novel forms of cognition that cannot be reduced to any historical cultural tradition. This uniquely positioned volume, oh my god, it keeps going. This uniquely positioned volume provides expert insight into this tension, using China as a touchstone for rethinking bunny quote marks, artificiality, and bunny quote marks, intelligence as sites of difference in a way that is already present in the difficulty of precisely translating the Chinese term ren gong something nung. Oh dear, let me just check what these last two characters are. Ah, I got it totally. Oh no, it was nung. Ren gong zhi nung. That just means artificial intelligence. I guess like ren gong would be man-made intelligence, different translation. Anyway, continuing this blurb. Tracking the history of Chinese AI from the pre-cultural revolution to the post-Deng Xiaoping eras right up to contemporary debates surrounding facial recognition, the writers in this collection draw on a mixture of speculative thought experiments and cutting-edge use cases to offer singular views on topics including AI and Chinese philosophy, AI ethics and policymaking, the development of computational models in early Chinese cybernetics, and the aesthetics of Sino-futurism. I think I need to read this book. There's still one more paragraph. Spanning borders between different worlds, histories, futures, and foundational models, Messine's decision is not final, is not only a timely reappraisal of the stakes of AI development, but a tool for constructing more global imaginaries for the future of AI. Bloody hell. Right, okay. Oh, it says on the Urbanomic website, the edition is supported by New York University Shanghai. Bogna, the editor and contributor, she's come up on the show before because she's sort of affiliated with this publisher, Urbanomic, is out there in Shanghai where... Oh man, this is venturing way out of the Chinese literature scene. But essentially, Shanghai has a little bit of a connection with Urbanomic for many reasons. If you want me to get into that, or want to hear me get into that, I have a bonus episode on my Patreon about sort of the murky history of that Shanghai magazine and a contributor who I'm not going to name, because if you know who I'm talking about, you know who I'm talking about, a guy who is in Shanghai right now. Yeah, go subscribe to Patreon if you want to get that scoop. There's your sales pitch. But yeah, anyway, so it seems like we have a selection of people affiliated with Urbanomic. Bogna is in there. Amy Ireland is another. Reza Nigristani, very much so. And then we also have a few figures from Chinese sci-fi scene. I mean, the ones I recognize are Chen Chiufan, Regina Kanyuang, and Xia Jia. But then there's a whole smorgasbord of other people here from all sorts of different backgrounds. So yeah, and oh my god. Maybe it's a terrible scholarship, but I don't know. I'm sure it's good, but my point is this book could have terrible scholarship. The arguments could be bad, but the vibes are so up my alley that I'm going to have to get this thing. Apparently it's 272 pages and it's priced at £16.99 or in US dollars, $19.95. Anyway, that's eaten up far too much time. So let's go to the next news item. Well, I should say, Messine's decision is not final. When is that coming out? Is it already out? It's forthcoming. I don't see a date. I'm not even sure I see a purchase link. So maybe you need to keep your eye on that one for the pre-order. Maybe it's up for pre-order on Amazon. I don't know. I need to get to the next news item. So this is something you can watch on YouTube. It's a reading, I believe. Yes, it's a reading from Paper Republic, author and translator, author Xu Xiaobin and translator Megan Copeland are, I guess, in this video doing a reading of a story set in the pandemic, a short story called The Cure All, seems to be about food. That's all I really know. You can watch this thing on YouTube. It's 8.5 minutes long. I'm not sure exactly how the reading works. I haven't watched this thing, if you can't tell. But yeah, it's a Paper Republic affiliated. So, you know, if you see that as a stamp of quality, then it has the stamp of quality. Okay, last news item. This one's a little bit speculative because the details aren't all hammered out. But I guess just like Paper Republic and sci-fi, this is another terrific staple. It's about Sinoist books. The UK-based publisher of lots of different translated Chinese fiction works, a natural ally of this show, you might say. They are planning a northern expedition in October in the UK. Although unlike the famous historical northern expedition, this one starts north, works its way down. Starts in the north of England specifically and works its way down south. So they're going to be doing a bunch of events promoting their books. I believe the first event will be in Manchester, and there'll be a little bit of a northern tour, and then, like I said, it'll end up in the south of England. Not all of the events are completely confirmed. Some of it is fluid. So in the show notes, I'll just link you to the Scenoist Books mailing list, or I believe it's under Ilian Charles Asia. Scenoist Books is an imprint of Ilian Charles Asia. But if you sign up to that mailing list, you can stay up to date with the plans for this exciting literary expedition across England that they're planning. In fact, I believe it's not just England. I think Edinburgh might be in the mix, but I've already forgotten. So you may want to subscribe to the mailing list for that one. I see I've been talking for 12 and a half minutes. That's a longer intro than the last few ones. So I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you didn't get fed up of me reading the blurb of Machine Decision is Not Final. But if you excuse me, I'm going to hit stop on this intro, and I'm literally just going to go see if I can pre-order this thing, because it was made for me. Anyway, try and enjoy listening to the interview. On the show, we have a very special guest. It's Fiona Te Laura. She's here to talk about a work she's translated. But before we get to that, Fiona, would you like to tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
I'm a little reticent about saying something about myself, but I can say something about my work.
Even better.
I'm a fiction writer, I'm a poet, and also a musician, a Zheng harpist, a Guzheng harpist, and I also translate. So I write and translate in English, French, and Chinese.
So you've told us a little bit about yourself, Fiona. That's excellent. Now, I know there's something we really got to let the listeners know before we dive into talking about our poems and our poetry. It's some fiction. So what is this fiction that we must let the listeners know about?
Yes, I just published a new novel and stories, Dear Chrysanthemums, from Scribner. And it's a novel and stories. It's a novel, but containing of interconnected stories about compelling Asian women, women of resilience across a span of, about 60 years or more, 1946 to 2016. We reckon with the past, violence and exile, and the stories are set in Shanghai, in Beijing, in Singapore, in Paris and New York, pretty much cities where I used to live, still live in, or grew up in.
So all stories set in large, very cosmopolitan cities, but we'll be going somewhere quite different for the text we're talking about in this episode. We're going down to the countryside, to Hengdian village, and we're going to be talking about an author, a poet, in fact, that you've translated. And there are works published in English. I don't know if there are also works published in French translation.
I believe so. I'm not the French translator.
Right,
I do
right. English. So our poet is Yu Xiuhua. And I guess we've given away that she writes poetry. But what sort of poetry does she write?
Well, Yu Xiuhua, in my opinion, is a poet who writes a lot of love poems and also a lot of poems about the natural world, about nature, much as I don't like to use those words, nature, natural world. I mean, we are part of nature. Nature is part of us in a way. I shouldn't go to the extent of saying that she's an eco-poet, although this label is very popular. There is a certain strong awareness of the environment and where she lives in her work. She's a farmer. So she does not shy away from calling herself a farmer poet. And she certainly does not shy away from introducing herself as a woman poet. And of course, in China, she's a celebrity poet. She has sold over 300,000 copies, and that's a record for Chinese poetry titles of the past 3 decades.
Oh, wow.
Yes, I think the numbers are still going up, in part because she's very vocal on the internet. She suffers from cerebral palsy, so she is a disabled poet. She uses that to describe herself, and it's refreshing in a way for the Chinese audience or Chinese readers. I suppose, well, I don't suppose, I think it's a fact that in China, disabled persons are often introduced to fairly unforgiving circumstances, discrimination, etc. So as in the poet Yu Xiuhua, through poetry, found new ways of redefining herself in the society given her situation. I should say that she was born in a very poor rural background. Certainly, her parents were not educated, were not literate. She was unable to attend college or find work, attend school. So she was trapped in a small village and an arranged marriage on top of her situation, on top of her disability. And so when she came on as a poet through the internet, that was new.
Yeah, it's amazing. I was going to say it sounds not only unique in China, but I struggle to think of any equivalent poet who's reached that level of fame anywhere. It's really special to me anyway. Not that I know my poetry so well. Maybe you've got a thought on that.
Well, she has a character too. I mean, she goes on talk shows and she seems to strike a chord among her fans. I think we can use that word for her, not just through her work, her writing, but also her way of handling life and difficulties. She often has a very original way of answering questions. I wrote it in my introduction. I remembered that there was a TV host who asked her something about love, and she said that the less love she has, the more she wants to write about it, and the host actually wishes her good luck in finding her true love. And Yu Xiuhua's answer was just simply, well, maybe in my next life. You know, so she often has a way, pretty naturally and in her awkward body language, to make clear that there's not much fuss to make out of her situation. And she's very aware of her problems, very aware of her ugliness. That's what you often say, but you know, she does not see that as ugly. She finds beauty in the world that she lives in. I don't mean to say that she thinks that she, you know, the appearance wise is ugly, but I meant to say that the world that she lives in is ugly with the suffering or whatnot. But she was able often to turn the table around and see the positive side of things, which we can imagine in the Chinese society can find a much larger following, or even in our world, in our Western world, and in other parts of the world. It's courageous, I would say. So I think in that sense, she's a source of inspiration for many people of the internet generation. In particular, I would say. She's very active on the internet. She answers questions. She tweets, you know, in the Chinese version context, Weibo. So they say she's able to maintain a presence despite it all, despite the fact that she lives in a very remote village. And despite the fact that she can't speak clearly, she seems to have found her way of communication much more easily than us all, in a way.
Absolutely. Yeah. So the work of hers that we're covering in this episode is Moonlight Rests on My Left Palm. Fiona assigned me a few pieces from the whole book to read. I did not read the whole thing. So I read, I think it's three poems we did and two essays. And I have to say, my impression on reading them, especially the essays, is that she's someone with a very clear-eyed view on life, existence, and ability to express it with her own opinions. And but yet also in the poetry, there's a real, this is where the fact I'm not really in the world of poetry, my words fail me, but there's a real more artistic, expressive side to her writing there that augments the sort of clear-eyed, almost unsentimental, but sometimes sentimental persona that comes off in those essays. What I wanted to ask you, Fiona, is so we've probably established, listeners will have realized you're the translator of the English edition of Moonlight Rests on My Left Palm. But beyond that, do you have a particular relationship with Xiuhua's work?
I would like to see myself as her reader, her close reader. I sort of have lived with her work for quite a few summers. I would say that when I was translating her work, it was a much more different experience than I have had in terms of other poets. I've met most other poets I translate, still translating. In her case, when I was translating her work, I couldn't help but kept asking myself how differently would I write had I lost a limb. And it made me think not just about my own writing, but writing with a capital W. What does it take to physicalize the act of writing? It's a difficult experience in that sense, because I realize how privileged I am next to her. I cannot possibly imagine myself putting myself in her shoes, because I just can't. It's just not possible. So the act, the work in itself took on a challenge. There are just simply things that I have to do my best to understand, but I can never have that experience, you know, to write, having lost a limb. And when I was sleeping, I had different dreams when I was, you know, working on her poems and her essays. And my only way of communication with her was through the internet, through the written, only because when we have a work task at hand, I need to get some of the answers accurately. And so, given that we are geographically apart, and given her situation, it's not as easy as just picking up the phone and talking about it, or just meeting over the Zoom. So the sort of ease I can have with other poets can be compromised in this situation. And I think that is the reality of her life, and that's the reality of the poems and the essays. So by extension, I asked questions to myself, you know, like in particular for a disabled woman farmer who lived in poverty in a communist and a male-dominated society, surrounded by unkind people and circumstances. What does it take to write, you know, to keep the faith? So that kept me going, and that kept my relationship with her work and her alive.
I think compromise, that's a word that struck me, because all of us living things who live and have to eventually die, we've all got to make some compromises with reality. But I guess it can be, it's n nice is too silly of a word, but I suppose it's a power that's there in writing, is you can be given a reminder of how slight your compromises are against someone else's. It's maybe a pretentious way to say we don't know how lucky we are, but yeah, just to, I can't imagine even being a farmer. That alone is something I could only get through being a reader, and I don't know. Yeah, it's special poetry. I've never read anything like it. Speaking of special poems, so the poem that made you go viral is it's in this book. I will leave the surprise because some, I think a lot of listeners won't see this coming. So I'll leave the surprise of its name to you, Fiona. What's that poem called? And do you think it's the best one in the book because it made her go viral? Or.
I don't know if it's the best or the worst in poetry. I don't know about what is good and bad in general, or winning or losing. In poetry, is often a question of how it speaks to you. In this case, it's a very Chinese specific phenomena, I suppose, in terms of cause and effect. The poem took on a very public virtual self at the end of 2014, I believe. Yes. When there was a strong reception of the internet culture in underground and mainstream poetry in China. So that was the time when Yu, that was not the time that she began to going online. She had gone online and pretty active at that point in time. But when this poem came on scene, she found an immediately sympathetic and curious audience for her personal experiences and writings. But it didn't mean that she was spared from constant criticism, discrimination, and struggles in life. Quite the contrary, it was a controversy. In a way, people started to ask whether she was a scandal or she was a cause célèbre. So the title of the poem, if you allow me, it's Crossing Half of China to Fuck You. So you imagine that coming from a woman, from a farmer, from a poet. In poetry, I mean, in a Chinese culture, poetry is about beauty. And also from someone who suffers from a disability. That's very loaded. So the responses, I would say, is pretty much a mix, and it continues to be a mix. I didn't right away choose the F word, fuck, to translate, but I ended up, sticking with it. In Chinese, it's shui, shui jiao de shui, but it's not sleep with you because it's shui ni, and that's vulgar in Chinese. Shui ni,
Right.
it means fuck you. There's no way to go around it. So if there are suppose I suppose there are different options traveling across half of China to sleep you, and then you put a footnote to explain, etc., or to screw you or what I've done through all sorts of options, and I believe that's just what the poet wants, crossing half of China to fuck you. So that's her reality, and I did not transpose it into mine. And in America, it created a shock effect that did not often that takes a while. I think that there are some readers that took a while to be comfortable with the distance, which surprised to me in a way. I mean, I was like, I'm okay with that. I understand. Well, we have to understand the context, I suppose. If we don't understand the context, you look at it, oh, it's vulgar. We don't understand why, and it's offensive. So I suppose I should read it.
I was going to say, if you'd like to read this poem or any of the others that we looked at, or if you'd like me to read them, we can go for it. I also wanted to say, if I may be vulgar, any cultural export that can shock the Americans, big thumbs up for me. That's an achievement. It's a worthwhile pursuit to shock Americans. But yes, if you'd like to read this one or either of the others,
You
please
can
do.
begin. You can begin and read
Okay.
it.
Shall I read this vulgar one and then maybe you could do one of the other ones?
Yes, of course.
Okay, great. Yeah. Well, here we go. I don't know how this will come out, but maybe that's part of the fun. Crossing half of China to fuck you. Fucking you and being fucked by you are quite the same, no more than the force of two colliding bodies. A flower coaxed into blossom, no more than a flower, a fictional spring we mistake for a renewed life. Half across China, anything can happen. Volcanoes erupt, rivers parch, some neglected political prisoners and refugees, an elephure and a Manchurian crane at gunpoint. I penetrate a hail of bullets to fuck you. I press countless dark nights into one dawn to fuck you. I, as many, run as one to fuck you. Of course, butterflies can lead me astray, and I think of some odes as spring. That's the one. I never expected to be saying anything like that on this show, but there you go.
Well, I find it useful to move past surface reactions about fuck, the word in itself, and not get distracted by its use.
Sure.
And once that's done, you can really locate the bones and the vitality of the poem, which is very dynamic.
The next things that grasped me after the F-bomb is the flower and the bullets. But even after those, there's lots more to sort of look at.
Well, beyond the fact that fuck is a form of vulgarity, in this case, it really touches on the use of a taboo, you know, the exposure to a taboo in a poem, in poetry, knowing that, you know, poetry is still somewhat of a establishment elitist expression in certain circles, perhaps in the Anglophone world. And here she is challenging us to look at it in a range of possibilities, from the pornographic to the moral and also to the political. I mean, the more I stay with this poem, the more it has its political implications. Half across China, anything can happen. Volcanoes erupt, rivers parched, some neglected political prisoners and refugees, and Manchurian crane at gunpoint. These are, in a way, she's moving towards a form of violence.
I was going to say, those are fighting words.
Yes. And that's her way of associating with lovemaking, fuck, and beyond the body. So who is doing what? What is China doing? Is China doing that to her? It's far beyond than just about her. And in this case, I should mention the fact that Yu Xiuhua suffered from an abusive husband before she had a divorce. So that played in, that pain played in. I think she was far from aestheticizing pain and suffering. We can see right away, you know, that she used the word fuck, and I penetrate a hail of bullets to fuck you. Very powerful, I thought, as an opening poem, as an opening poem for the book. So sort of like plunges the reader right into it. And so that was the poem that that went viral.
Would you like to read one this time, one of the other ones we picked?
Yes. Let's see. I don't think I sent this, but I would love to read it. Oh, I thought it's beautiful. Background. After rounds of rain, a tree grows thin. The sun is out on dark, moldy leaves. How unattractive. Such a blue sky to cover Hengdian village. Such white clouds to drift over white poplars. Newly planted barley flicks out a coat of furry green. Wheat wither out a gripping hour. I sit in a field. Autumn wind enters my bosom. Sparrows, crew by crew, down and up in a swell, falling on a telephone line over the crops, so softly, not bearing to alarm sporadic news from afar. So as you can see, it's completely different
Yeah.
from the first poem we heard. So this
Yeah.
to say that we should not be just focusing at, and I mentioned this only because her first poem went so viral that people just sort of like fixated her to that poem and overlooked, neglected the rest of her body of work, the rest of all her other poems, which are very beautiful, lyrical, tender, surprisingly, central and sensitive to nature and little details in her pastoral world, not bearing to alarm sporadic news from afar. In a way, it's not just news, but news from the internet, because that was her source of information. So,
Yeah.
yeah.
A thing that struck me about the rural side of her poems, and I think we mentioned before, Hung Dien is that's where she lives. That's where she's from. That's the village named in that poem, in this poem. There is a book that I think I've referenced on this show before, and it's a little embarrassing because this is just one I was assigned to read way back in high school. And if someone's only reference points for books are things they were given in school, maybe indicates they haven't read a lot. But I will reference this one anyway. So it's a Scottish novel. That's where I'm from. That is about farmers. It's called Sunset Song. And a big theme the teacher tried to get us to look at was the relationship between big characters, especially the main character, who's a woman who ends up in a troubling marriage, and the land. And it's sort of reminds me of this because a thing they maybe have in common is there are beautiful descriptions of the land and the environment, but there's also very unsentimental ones. The land's something in Sunset Song that people kind of have to struggle with, work with in a struggle rather than struggle against. And in this poem, although there's some really beautiful description of the natural sort of, I guess, what we assume is Xiuhua's surroundings, it reminded me of times I've sat down somewhere quiet in the countryside and just observed, the background. There's no foreground, so the background becomes what you absorb. But there are other things, like there's dark, moldy leaves, withering trees, sorry, withering weeds, thinning trees. But there's other surprising things, like there's a gripping hour. There's crews of sparrows. Makes me think of, I don't know, like crews of people being sent out to the countryside or something. I'll finish this point. I think there's maybe a common thread between maybe certain kinds of poets all over the world, maybe in China and maybe in Europe, where they have this romantic idea of going out to the countryside to enjoy nature, to go back to the rural roots or whatever. But if you're from the upper class, it's easy to have that nice idea of what it's like to be among nature, because you're going to be insulated from the hard side, because you're wealthy, I suppose. Whereas Xiuhua is a farmer, and I feel like that's maybe why she'll mention the moldy leaves or the fact that some of the plants might be dying or something, or she'll call it unattractive as well as giving us pretty details. So that's, I don't know, that was a long spiel. Maybe that's a very simple analysis, but that's sort of what I was thinking of as you were reading.
Well, she struggles along with the nature and the natural world. In a way, she internalizes the problems of nature. In a couple of her essays, she really spoke about the disappearance of her village and all the various environmental problems that her village and the villagers had to encounter because of modernization, climate changes, and the different ways of farming that became more and more challenging for the villagers. So it's a far more complex relationship that she had and she has and she continued to have and sustaining with nature. She finds strength in it, but she pretty much internalizes the tension and lives through it. I suppose that's it's always interesting to ask farmers how they feel about their crops. What would they say? Well, the crops are doing fine. There's always something else to that. That's what I would have thought as an immediate response. Of course, we are all very distanced from that now that we are, most of us are in, are in the urban settings. But for Yu Xiuhua, she pretty much went through the whole entire conflicted experience of seeing how the nature and the natural world got sucked into becoming a semi-urban setting, and people fighting over the lands to keep whatever that needs to be kept for the crops, and then the villagers being literally chased to new buildings, and with modernity, how that got really pushed into the lives of the villagers. That was a very strong urgency that she highlighted in her writings, in her essays. She gave more context to it. It was pretty much in parallel with China's modernization, aggressive policies in modernizing remote villages to make them accessible to the cities, to the surrounding cities. All of it. She still lives in Hengdian, by the way. So, I mean, it's a very much changed Hengdian, as she confesses in her writings, but she's still where she is. So, I believe she also wrote about finding one's roots. And she sort of ironizes it by saying that we might have to do with the fact that simply she can't go anywhere anyway, given the fact that she's disabled. There's truth in it, but the twist that she gives to this truth, it's very poignant, I suppose.
I certainly remember in the year before I was going to leave home, and go off and do my own things. That was when I was meditating the most on what's like the atmosphere of my local area and becoming more attentive to it. But that is a big side tangent. I won't go into that. I will make a recommendation for listeners. Maybe if you're a listener who, I don't know, isn't living in China, so you don't have much knowledge or experience of material questions in the Chinese countryside. There's a very readable book called. It's a non-fiction book called In Manchuria, A Village Called Wasteland and the Transformation of Rural China. And it's by a guy, some Western fellow. He has a Chinese wife from this very small village up in Dongbei, northeast China. And I think he spent a year or half a year in this town and sort of got to know the people. Actually, half the book he's traveling Manchuria, and it's about sort of his experiences in the history, sort of a travelogue. But the other, like every second chapter, is about just sort of the village life, village transformation. And the thing that was going on while he was there is a farming company was setting up, I think assisted by the local government, building these like apartments in the village with all the modern furnishings for the older, I think mostly old people, but the rural residents to move into. And it sort of sounds like some of the concerns that Xiuhua has been facing in Hundian, you might get a taste of that. A taste, that's not the right word. A feeling for that in that book. Oh yes, the other thing I was going to say, we shouldn't dawdle too much, but I wanted to say this about the modern world encroaching into the Chinese countryside. Oh, and so is the virtual world, the internet, the Chinese countryside's been connected online. And for all the pros and cons of that, we've got Xiuhua. And I've seen mediated through Western social media the odd clip of like people in the Chinese countryside going viral, doing, I don't know, showing off their life, or I don't know, performing, I don't know, all the silly things that can make you go viral, it seems are just as easy to do in the Chinese countryside as they are in, say, one of the big cities. And I don't know, I just find it very interesting.
There's a certain level of hygienic thinking, a certain level of sanitized thought that got to do with the political climate, the current political climate. Living in poor remote country is shameful.
Right.
I think it's part of the communist ideology to dominate and tame the organic in a way.
I was sorry to interrupt, but I remember thinking when I was living in China, gosh, there's real emphasis on strength and winning. I wonder if there's some of that as well. Like, if you're not top quality, if you're not the best.
Well, yes, so if you live in a farm in a remote countryside that does not yield high agricultural output, the land is lousy. So all that sorts of grading, and even with tea, there's high grade, A grade, B grade, competitiveness, competition. It's pretty much de naturalized. And even organic farming in itself is an economy. So there's a social tag to being ashamed of where one comes from if one comes from an impoverished village in an unknown place, county, somewhere in the vast China. So it brings me back to the point that I want to make is that Li Xiuhua is aware of that on top of her so-called shame as being disabled woman, poet, who consistently suffers in pain all the time, can't walk properly, always swaying, can't talk properly, and whenever she talks, her face is contorted. Put this in a huge, larger reality, her environment, a land that isn't always green, etc. She's sort of brought up the subject of shame, and in a way urges people to talk about, to confront it. What is beauty and what is ugliness? What is goodness? And ultimately, what is nature? Beginning as her as an example, if we want to look at her as a piece of land, I mean, this is a crude metaphor, but I think somewhere in her essays, she actually talk about that. What if I'm that earth, me as the earth, and then here the land. So I might be going a little far, but by extension, I was thought is that the kind of future, agricultural future, that she's hinting at, that a country, that the country that she knows, that she knew, the land that she grew up with, that she was aware that it's fast disappearing. I'm afraid that's a problem, and that's always a question that's weighing on a lot of parts of the Chinese population, Chinese people who are aware, who are conscious, who are lucid. I mean, it's hard to survive in a country that comes up with policies about the air. I mean, the air is not something that you can draw policies about. You can't control it. But I suppose in this current government, it's possible. It's probably even possible to draw boundaries and decide that this air goes to this and that country. I mean, I have no idea. That's another poet here talking, but
Yes, what was I going to say? Yeah, a thing I think I learned in my first year living in China is you may not see so much of it being a foreigner living in it. First, I was a town on the edge of the countryside first, but even then I was so insulated from the countryside. But many a book or another more veteran expat or a Chinese friend would say, yeah, the real big thing you want to understand, or the real big division in society, it's the countryside and the towns, and that's the fundamental thing, and a thing that's shifted so much. Because I guess I think there's people who still say China is primarily an agricultural country before it's anything else. And yeah, I guess you only need to look at the size and the population and the divide between some of the hyper-modern cities. And like even getting the train out of Shanghai, it's not long before you're in like another society, it felt like to me anyway, just looking out the window. I would like to go on and on about that, but we're trying to do a quick interview today. So if you don't mind, I'll usher us into the sort of miscellaneous wind down section. First miscellaneous question is, if you could think of a word of the day to pair with Xiaohua's work, does one spring to mind?
Yes, I thought of the word wu, 觉悟 的悟, Sun Wukong wu, which
Okay.
actually means realize, enlighten, understand, awaken. In her poems, when I translate her work, I always at some point I always have the feeling that that's the moment of some awakening, that's the moment of some self-realization, that's the moment of some realization. It might just be a ray of little hope there, and that was interesting to me. The word, the character Wu, is made up of xin zi pang, the radical, that's xin zi pang, radical heart, you know, the heart, and then wu means me in ancient Chinese. So the heart has me, and so we realize something as some sort of a form of self-knowledge, I think.
Self-knowledge, that's perfect.
Yeah,
Awesome.
I mean, I had other words that came to mind, you know, like kong, but I thought wu was more. Of course, that's just my reading, my interpretation.
That's fine. If I was to think of one with my quite limited vocabulary, it would have been a rhyme. It would have been tu for like earth. But that's an easy one to think of for a farming
Well,
poetry.
I think Yu Xiuhua would like that very much, the two. You know, it's funny because in a couple of interviews, she said something close to like 我很老土. You know, lao tu, I'm very old fashioned, old earth, you know, lao tu, and we know that the adjective when we say someone is very lao tu, it's negative. It means the person is not adaptable, fixed, old fashioned, backward, and precisely in her work in this book, Moonlight Rests on My Left Palm. She questioned actually, she questioned about what is forward looking and what is backward looking and what exactly is that, you know, backward and forward, and how much forward have we become? And in fact, we, you know, in her world, by being forward, introducing all sorts of technology, sometimes one just ends up taking a few back steps and fixing the problems in being forward. So I thought that was rather philosophical, this backward forward movement that she was hinting at. So two is a good word, simple.
I can only think of simple words. Those are the ones I know, but
Well,
often the most useful.
simplicity is often the hardest. In fact, it's always the hardest, I suppose.
Very true.
Yeah.
I know I should keep moving, but I just wanted to say the point about being sort of set in your ways or backward. I feel that if it's a sort of a dilemma or a, I don't think it's a contradiction, I'll say dilemma. If you really want to sort of have a better life, a good way to do it perhaps is to know yourself or to be clear-eyed. And I think that's been part of me for, I'm still not clear-eyed, I don't think, but part of growing up, I'm 30 now, has been trying to become more clear-eyed, more and more aware of who I am in the world and whatnot. But I think potential problem with that is once you, the more clear-eyed and straighter in your thinking or apprehension of the world you become, perhaps the more fixed you might be, the more conscious you are of yourself and what you think, there's a risk of calcifying or freezing. I guess I've not really read enough of Xiaohua to see if she comes across as particularly stubborn, but I did get the sense that she really knows what she thinks. So maybe it might be interesting for her readers to see how her thoughts and her writing change over time in her career. I don't know if you like the word career, but her career as a poet.
Her writing life,
The
perhaps.
writing life, yeah.
Yeah. Well, she certainly is strong-minded, strong-willed. I mean, she got out of her abusive marriage all by herself. She had helped, and she certainly found help by asking for it. You know, she was not. I wouldn't imagine her as a passive victim. And I wouldn't imagine that she would like to see herself as a victim. So, coming to your point about seeing things clearer, I got a sense that you were hinting at being objective.
I was trying not to say that so bluntly, but maybe just having the ability not just to express yourself in your words, but also in your thoughts, fooling yourself less. And by being able to fool yourself less, you might oh man, the words are failing me again. There's maybe a danger in being very sort of determined in how you go through the world and being over determined. I failed again to get across what I mean. I think what you said about having a strong will.
I think it's fundamentally about living a authentic life, to live as authentically as possible. I often mention this, I suppose, only because it's important, I think, at least in my own work. It's a certain level of emotional honesty and emotional coherence.
Honesty and coherence, yeah, that's something I was trying to say.
Emotional honesty. Emotional coherence. It might seem a little odd to imagine that we don't own our emotions as artists, but it's not, because there's always the level of expectations in an economy, how much the book would sell if you go this way, how the poem would be read if it's written that way. I think to some extent, we have self-censorship here, you know, the process of editing and revision and whatnot. And there they have censorship. I don't know which is better, which is worse. We all understand that we are living in a much less freer world, much more inspected and policed. And yet we claim to have much more connections with one another and with internet, which is casting almost the widest net ever possible, connecting people. But it's a double-edged knife everywhere.
Oh, gosh, so many different roads to wander down there. I'm going to discipline myself and go to the next question. It's similar to the last one, and if you don't have something, you can skip it. Don't worry, because I have an answer for this one ready. If you could pair Moonlight, Rest on My Left Palm, or any one of the pieces in it with a piece of music, what piece of music would it be?
I was tempted not to choose a piece of music that could do with Clair de Lune, you know, with the moon and stuff, just because the title has Moonlight Rest on My Left Palm, and choosing a Moonlight Sonata or whatnot might be too much of the obvious. But the reality is, the first piece of music that came to me was any of the nocturnes by Gabriel Fauré. French composer, piano music, soothing, meditative. I hate the word meditative, I have to say, because immediately It brings up all sorts of stereotypical imaginations, such as being calm, etc. Quite the contrary, Yu Xiuhua herself actually said that she's not calm. She's never a calm person. But in poetry, she found a calming effect, like a even if it sounds like a stereotypical and example analogy, she used it anyhow. Soothing river source or wellspring coming in, chest echoing through her, clouds echoing through her chest. You know, that sort of coolness. So yes, I would suggest that music.
Wonderful. I struggled with this one, partly because I was trying to think of one about 30 minutes before the start of our interview, but I picked one by an artist I just saw on stage quite recently called Lyra Lin. The song's called Illusion, and it's the first track from an album she wrote after just getting through, I think it's, now this is bad, I should know the word, postpartum, the depression parents, especially women, can have after giving birth when they don't feel right or don't, you know, something for whatever reason, they've given birth, they have a child, but they fall into a depression. And I believe I don't know if she wrote the music after she came out of it or not, but she wrote this album that was to a very large extent a meditation on her new life as a mother or being a mother, which doesn't quite sound like a match for Yu Xiuhua's poetry. But this song, Illusion, its sort of main hook, catchy line is, love, is this love, is this illusion taking over me?
Love, is this love, is this illusion taking over me? Oh, and how would it feel to make it real, like it was meant?
It's sort of just stuck in my head, that's sort of why I chose it, but I think some of the vibe of the album is maybe in Xiuhua's poetry. Some of it's very peaceful, some of it's very beautiful, a lot of it is about love, seems to be love for a newborn child, which is not what one often,
well, she has a son, she has
right
a son.
Right,
and in many of her love poems she has a projected lover. You know, much as she herself did not want to confess it, she felt that the love is impossible, just as she writes it. She does feel unwanted, abandoned, oftentimes, at least in her poems. I mean, now she's, to my knowledge, she has a second marriage, and it's... So love is all not that impossible, even though, you know, in the interview that I mentioned, she immediately just answered back that perhaps my next life. So to her, it's always something that might just be no more than a fleeting thought or a fleeting wish. Again, it's the distance, the impossibility, so far yet so near. And I think that is what sort of fuels the erotic appeal in her poems too. If you read it from the perspective, I shouldn't say that, if we read it in her context. Yeah.
I'm going to discipline myself and only say one more thing about Lyra Lin and Xiuhua. At the gig, the performance where I saw Lyra playing, she played the title track from this album, which is Something More Than Love. And it's deep, it's moving, it's not obvious, but at an obvious level, it's about how this feeling she has for this kid is hard, you know, hard to describe, way beyond a normal affection. And it's very deep and very strong, blah, blah, blah.
And after she played the song, someone from the crowd shouted, "Lucky kid," referring to like her boy. Oh, he's so lucky to be loved so much. But side note, it's unusual for me listening to like a Western modern musician to be writing about something like this. It feels very, I don't know, like from another world. But anyway, Lyra replied back to that audience member. She said something like, "Well, you don't really have a choice. It just sort of happens." So like she doesn't, guess she's well aware that the emotions aren't really hers. A lot of the more ponderous songs in the album are sort of, yeah, they're wrestling with the strangeness of love, and maybe not in the same way Xiaohua does, but I feel like there's a parallel. Okay, so now we're going to the section of the show that I snip out for Patreon supporters. So listeners to the main feed, you're just, after I ask the question, you're just going to hear blah, 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 blah. If you want to hear Fiona's answer to this one, it will be going up on Patreon. So I'm actually condensing a few here, but I think they should all sort of fit on a theme. So I wanted to say to Fiona that, well, she already mentioned she doesn't just translate. I was going to ask her about her other projects. Then I was going to ask, is there an overarching project behind all your projects? And sort of third level of the cake here, or third level of the tower, what do you think it means to work across cultures in art and literature? So take that one anywhere you like. And we all need a little comfort to survive.
And to keep the status quo.
Yeah. Okie dokie. I'll close off the bonus question there. I hope that has some of the subscribers scratching their heads. Or maybe they got it right away. Maybe they're on the same vibration. We mentioned at the top of the show that you've got a book out yourself, Dear Chrysanthemums. So listeners, do pick that up. Is there anything else you're working on just now you'd like to share?
I'm superstitious. I don't talk about things I'm working on. I talk about things I've finished.
I think that's wise.
There's a saying, you never announced pregnancy, you announced the birth of the child. So.
Okay. So perhaps you're working on something, time will tell.
I hope so. In the main, I must say after a novel, it's often a period of rest and taking care of the novel.
yeah. Okay. Well, we wish you all good luck in promoting Dear Chrysanthemums. And again, listeners, find the link to go get that one in the show notes. On that note, I'll say thank you very much for your time, Fiona. It's been an interesting discussion. I'm going to at some point read the rest of this book because I did really enjoy the bits that we covered for the show. And yes, just again, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Okay, we've reached the end of the show. How exciting. Is it exciting? No, it's not particularly exciting to have reached the end of the show. What am I talking about? Anyway, we have reached the end. So once again, a big thank you to Fiona for coming on. A wonderful interview and indeed a wonderful author and book to be looking at. And if listeners, if you didn't glean, I've not actually read that whole book yet. Just the, I think it was three poems, two essays that I read in advance of the show. I will be reading the rest of that book because I thought that was beautiful and very special stuff if you didn't gather that from my chat with Fiona. And also, I'll reiterate again, do go check out Fiona's new book, Dear Chrysanthemums, if that sounds of interest to you. Reading the title could be a good way for you to practice pronouncing chrysanthemum. You see, I need practice. Chrysanthemums. Much easier to say in Mandarin than in English, that word. For sure. No matter what language you speak, it's easier in Mandarin. Anyway, I am talking absolute shit, which probably means it's time for me to get to the plugs, where you can go if the show is something you enjoy. So maybe one thing you can do that would make me very happy, and indeed something you should do before I put the thing on hiatus, is you can, you know, support the show. There is a support the show link on the website homepage at churchific.com, T-R-C-H-F-I-C.com. On that support page, you've got links to the show Patreon, the show Buy Me a Coffee, And there's a PayPal link as well. So if you want to like give a one-off contribution to help cover the show's hosting fees and maybe help me buy the occasional pint of overpriced beer here in inflation crisis Britain, then buy me a coffee, or you know, buy me a pint, as it were, and PayPal are good for that. If you want to get something in turn for supporting the show, Patreon's your best bet. You can contribute, I think it's a minimum of £1, possibly in the States it's $1, I don't know, but call it £1 a month or more if you want. You can get access to all the bonus shows I put up. I've got a new episode queued up every 2 weeks into August, I think. So we're looking pretty safe there for a long time. I will be putting up more, or queuing up more. Hopefully the queue will extend all the way into 2024. I can do that. I've got enough time to do that. But yeah, there's already, there's more than 100 bonus eps up there. Maybe 150? There's a lot. Some of them are quite short, say maybe between five and 10 minutes. Some are really quite long, an hour or more. Probably the majority of them are landing between 20 and 40 minutes. Most of them are solo. It's just me sharing my thoughts on a book I've covered on the show, maybe when I'm halfway through the book, maybe thoughts we didn't hit on in the interview. But also often there's books that are somewhat relevant to Chinese lit, but don't really qualify for the show. Maybe it's one I couldn't get a guest for. Maybe it's one that's written in English. Like right now I'm reading Ken Liu's The Grace of Kings, which is a very Sino book, but it's not translated, so I wouldn't cover it on the show. But I think I've already got thoughts about it, and I'm only 77 pages in. So yeah, maybe I will do a bonus episode on that one. That could be fun. And I, you know, undoubtedly I'll get everything horrendously wrong, and it'll be offensive, and you'll be filled with an urge to complain, which you can do. If you want to get in touch with me, or indeed with other listeners, there are a few places you can go. There is the show's Instagram. It's at Churchific on Instagram, at TRCHFIC. I'm on Twitter myself, as myself, at Angus Likes Words. I don't tweet that much, but sometimes I retweet interesting things. Or you can go through my likes and see all the dubious things I've liked. Don't do that. Or do. If you're obsessive, do. There's also a Discord, although it's basically dead. You can make it come to life on the Discord. Or indeed, if you want to pitch a question to everyone else on the Discord, you can do that. It's also a way to zap me a message directly, but you can do that on Instagram and Twitter as well. So yeah, whatever. Gosh, I've stretched this out. I'll end by, as I always do, by telling you the best things you can do for the show. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell the farmer in your village. I'm trying to think of like other people named, other characters you might draw from Moonlight Rests on my left palm, but like the only one that springs to mind is the physically abusive husband. And I'm not going to say something like, tell your physically abusive husband. That would be very edgy, and I'm not edgy. I'm a very nice man. So please walk away from this episode with that thought, that the host is a very nice man. That would be good. So with that thought resting on your left palm, I will bid you Zaijian.
遮住全身